Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week, a history of cells. Adam Rutherford is here to tell us all about what we and all other living things are made of. Also,
I believe that the most powerful symbol that we can find is something flying with no fuel, because everybody believes it's impossible. The technology is already here. The problem is the lack of political vision.
The first of our interviews with some of the speakers from the recent TED Global Conference. We'll kick off with a man who wants to build a solar plane. All that, plus the secrets of the inkblot test, why we swing our arms when we're walking, and the return of an ancient clockwork computer. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. The pod's a bit quiet today, but don't worry, I'm not going to spend half an hour just talking to myself. First up is pod regular Adam Rutherford, who's just made a programme for BBC Four. Cell charts the history and biology of one of the most basic subunits of all living things. One of the first times people saw cells was when Dutch linen maker Antony van Leeuwenhoek decided to examine things other than textiles with his magnifying glass.
The full meaning of what he saw in that universe, seen here down a modern microscope, escaped van Leeuwenhoek. He assumed he was seeing miniaturised versions of everyday animals with beating hearts and contracting muscles, just like their larger counterparts. He called them animalcules. Little did he know, it wasn't just a question of scale.
That was a clip from Cell with my guest today, Adam Rutherford. When he came in, I began by asking him, don't we all know what cells are?
I'm not sure that everyone does know what cells are. I think there's a basic sort of general understanding that cells are biological components that all living things have. But the story of the cell is a story which isn't told very often. And you've got the first grand unifying theory of biology was cell theory. And it comes before the theory of evolution, and it comes before the structure of DNA. But basically says the same thing, which is that all life is made of cells by definition. And the second an equally important thing is that cells can only come from other cells. And so the implications of that second bit are really profound, because it gives you an absolute trace back to the very first cell. It is the tree of life done at a cellular level. Every single cell that has ever existed has a direct lineage to the first cell that existed maybe 4 billion years ago. And that's pretty profound.
So just so that we're all on the same page for the rest of the conversation, what is a cell? What are the major components of a biological cell?
Well, in essence, a cell is a self-contained unit which is capable of reproducing itself. That's very simplistic answer betrays the enormous diversity of the cells that exist on people, or the different species of cells, from bacteria to eukaryotic cells, which animals are made of. And it's a really difficult question to answer in detail, because all life is made of cells, and they have very similar components but can be very different. So typically in a eukaryotic cell you have a cell membrane, which is a layer which contains all the gubbins inside. Typically in most cells you have a nucleus, which contains all of the DNA, or the information that encodes a whole genome of a whole organism. And then there are various other bits and pieces which are all equally important, like mitochondria, which are the sort of powerhouse of the cells, and then the ribosome, which is the cell factory, which converts DNA from DNA to RNA to protein, which are the things that do all the work for biological organisms.
So before we knew there were cells, what did people think that plants and people were made of?
There was this general notion that, which dates back to the Greeks, that different types of organism were made of stuff which was specific to them. And it wasn't until cell theory emerged that it became clear that there was this unity, that all living things were made of cells which were fundamentally similar, although different. And then another question that stemmed from Greek thought, which is where new tissue comes from, where new organisms come from. And there were some crazy ideas, the best of which is spontaneous generation. Now, this was the idea that new creatures just sprung forth out of nothing. Now, they sound completely nuts to us, but for thousands of years, people thought that bees, for example, emerged spontaneously from the rotting corpses of bulls, and that crocodiles actually were logs in swamps that just somehow, if you left a log in a swamp for long enough, it would turn into a crocodile.
Were these clever people?
These were smart people. And in fact, one of the things we did in the program was to repeat an experiment by a guy called Van Helmont, who was a really serious chemist, probably the father of gaseous chemistry. But he also believed in spontaneous generation. And what he did is he set up an experiment to demonstrate that mice spontaneously generated from ears of wheat and a sweaty shirt. So what he did is he got a sweaty shirt that he'd been wearing for 21 days. It was very important that it was 21 days. Stuffed it into a vase with some ears of wheat. Left it for 21 days in his damp cellar in his castle in Bavaria. Came back 21 days later and lo and behold, there are mice there. And this was the idea about where mice came from. We repeated the experiment and we didn't find any mice. It was really surprising.
They'd cottoned onto this, hadn't they, by now, the mice.
I think so.
But let's move on a couple of hundred years. The future of these things, what can you do with these things? Our understanding of cells has allowed us to understand disease and biology. But what's good the next century of understanding on this subject going to be about?
Well, it's interesting that because we don't know that much about the abiogenesis, which is how you get from inanimate chemicals to the very first cell, which happened probably 4 billion years ago. It's using modelling that sort of system, which makes perfect sense. The scientists use the phrase plausible when they make advances in this field. It's plausible that this happened and actually turned into something which might be a constituent of the cell. It's modelling that system of 4 billion years ago, which has allowed the new field of synthetic biology to develop, and that is creating cells from scratch, which is what the true pioneers of biology are doing. So to answer your question, I believe we're now entering the era of the cell. We can almost create cells from scratch, and we can, through genetic engineering, we can manipulate cells to do pretty much what we want.
So using the machinery that cells have used to make living organisms, using that machinery specifically to make all sorts of things, like fuels or whatever.
Right. So we filmed a company in California who have engineered E. coli to produce pure diesel, and to see in real time bacteria secreting oil, which they then pipette off into a jar, we put it straight into a generator and kick the generator off. You know, that's pretty amazing. We've already got cells producing anti-malarial drugs by the bucket load because reducing the cost of producing those drugs by a factor of 10.
So this is the new engineering.
It really is, and I think that what's crucial about synthetic biology is the people doing it think like engineers. They don't really think like biologists at all. And it's really visionary. It's kind of weird and a bit freaky to talk to these people because they don't sound like biologists. They sound like people playing with Lego.
So one more question before we wind up. There is that fundamental question in the emergence of life on Earth is you have these inanimate molecules, complicated molecules, DNA, RNA, etc. How did they become something that ended up replicating themselves? Because DNA just can't do it without protein. Protein doesn't exist without DNA. So it's a big of a vexed question. And the cell is this architecture around this DNA. What do we know about that time? What is there that is the most plausible explanation for that structure to turn up?
We don't have a definitive answer, but there are lots of really robust ideas about how it happened. A couple of months ago, this isn't in the program, but a couple of months ago, a paper published in Nature had a group spontaneously forming uracil, which is one of the components of RNA, not of DNA. It's the fifth letter of genetics. Spontaneously forming in the lab in the right conditions. And those conditions, they think, are similar to how the Earth might have been 4 billion years ago. At exactly the same time, there's a group in Imperial, who we spent some time with in making the program, who found and verified that they'd found uracil in a meteorite, the Murchison meteorite, which landed in Australia in 1969, same year that Armstrong walked on the moon. Now, this is astonishing. We're talking about a highly complex molecule which is absolutely essential for all living things. And it exists in a meteorite. It exists in space. Now, it's really important that we don't say that life started in the universe and landed on Earth. That's called panspermia, and that's not really accepted. It's a bit flaky as an argument. But it's perfectly reasonable to say that some of the components which are essential for life may have been seeded off-world. And, you know, again, I don't know about you, but I just think that's nuts. That's awesome.
That was Adam Rutherford talking about his new programme on BBC4, Cell. The first of those goes out at 9 o'clock on August the 12th. Let's have a look now at this week's science stories. Ian Samples here to go through the news jam.
News jam.
The secrets of the Rorschach inkblot test, which is meant to give psychologists an insight into patients' unconscious, have been revealed on Wikipedia. Patients are meant to describe the first thing that comes into their head when they look at the symmetrical splodges, so psychologists fear the test will now be devalued.
A biomechanics expert thinks he has discovered why we swing our arms as we walk. Apparently, arm swinging counteracts the twisting forces on our bodies as we stride along. The extra effort involved in holding our arms rigid at our sides is the equivalent of carrying two bags of shopping, said Steve Collins at Delft University in the Netherlands.
A major review has revealed that human activity is driving the sixth great wave of extinctions in the Earth's history. Conservationists say disease and human activity are having devastating effects on biodiversity, with Australia, New Zealand and the Pacific Islands faring particularly badly.
And finally, an ancient clockwork computer recovered by sponge divers from the wreck of a Roman vessel in 1901 may be even older than archaeologists suspected. A Greek name inscribed on the Antikythera mechanism, which tracked the motions of the planets and marked the dates of major sporting events, suggests it may have been made in the 2nd century BC.
Ian, thanks for that. Let's go into two of those really quickly. The story about swinging your arms about is actually makes walking easier. Take us through some of the detailed aspects of this, because obviously no one knew this before.
Well, there was one theory that was still pretty valid, or still pretty well backed up, at least, in the 80s, where people wondered whether the reason we swung our arms when we walked along was actually some kind of evolutionary vestige of getting around on all fours, because these people look at us swinging our arms as we walk and say, well, that's not really helping us sort of in our locomotion. I think most of us realize that you swing your arms because it actually just feels better. It feels right. There's something in the grace of it, if you like. What this guy did, though, he actually looked at the energy involved in walking in different ways. So what I mean by that is walking normally, swinging your arms sort of as you do. The other one, having your arms rigid down by your side. And the other one is this walk he calls the Sears walk, as in sort of the kind of pose favored by catalog models, where you're right leg and right arm go forward at the same time, and then your left leg and left arm go forward at the same time. You're walking a bit like a robot. If you look at how these work out energetically, it costs you about 12% more energy to walk around with your arms straight down by your sides. And if you want to do this sort of Sears catalog walk, it costs you 26% more energy. So it's all down to what makes it easier for us to walk.
Which can't be bad if you want to lose weight, say, and you decide that you want to walk to lose weight. You should walk with the Sears catalog walk. You burn more calories, right?
That's exactly right. And the reason it takes more energy to walk like that is, well, the reason it's easiest to walk the way we do is by swinging our arms kind of counter to our legs, we cancel out the twisting forces on our legs as we move forward. And if we didn't do that, we would have to use our leg muscles and so on to keep us going in a straight line. Swinging your arms, you don't have to do that so much.
Well, moving on to the next story, this is the Rorschach inkblot test. This is a kind of famous thing where you look at symmetrical patterns of ink on a piece of paper and say whatever comes into your head, and it's used as narrative devices in all sorts of films and things. This, I didn't even know that this had an official psychological or scientific basis in any way. So what's been revealed exactly?
So there's been a discussion on Wikipedia, the Wikipedia Rorschach page, for a year or so now over whether they were right to display one of the ink blots, one of the Rorschach ink blots. There are 10 in the entire test that you're supposed to give to patients. One of the people who was aware of this decided, well, you know, all you people are arguing about taking down one picture, and he decided to put all 10 plates up. So now you can go on the Wikipedia page and you can see all of the Rorschach inkblot tests. Now, the psychologists out there, most of them at least, have a problem with this, because they say that if you make these tests public, and also what was posted were the most common answers, the most common interpretations of these images. If you do that, then you can diminish their value because patients who are given these tests are really supposed to say exactly what comes to their mind straight away. And if they've been cribbing up and like on looking on Wikipedia and seeing what you're supposed to say, they'll either, you know, just repeat those answers pat, and it won't really help diagnose them with anything or say anything about their sort of inner issues. But it also make them think more about these things, and they'll study the images and so on. And so, you know, it probably diminishes their value.
But what does this say about the value of this test anyway? Is there some psychological value to it? Couldn't they just come up with a bunch of new images? I mean, if they're random ink splotches, you could just come up with 10 new ones, surely. Why use the same ones anyway?
Well, it depends who you ask. I mean, a lot of psychologists I spoke to said that these tests are, in the UK at least, used in a very limited fashion now because it's so open to interpretation by the particular psychologist, even though you can rank them and there are ways of quantifying people's responses. Now, those 10 plots are very particular. And you could say you could come up with a whole load of new ones. But what has happened in the sort of the literature, the psychological journals and so on, is that people have studied these things and studied patients' responses to them in thousands of papers. So it's really well researched, at least. And you have a lot of, you know, studies that have been done on these particular templates. If you then make those templates invalid, and you start with some new ones, you have to really go through and characterize them all again, because, you know, the way people respond to these things, it's a very iffy science, and if it's a science at all. And anyway, the advocates of this study just aren't particularly happy about it.
Well, this bit might not work on audio, but the picture that was with your article, this is the classic inkblot thing. What do you see what do you think when you see that picture? I'd encourage people to go into the website and have a look at the picture that Ian's about to describe. What is it?
I see it as an angry witch with an axe coming to kill me.
That's interesting, actually. Interesting.
I see
Silence of the Lambs. Yeah. For some reason, that butterfly thing. Mind you, all these pictures make me slightly terrified. You can see that picture, of course, on our website. If you go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly, there's a link to all those stories. And also there's a link to James Randerson's blog on that final story we didn't really have time to talk about, which is the Antikythera mechanism. And also, if you look back through the archives of Science Weekly, there's an interview with Jo Marchant, who wrote a book on the Antikythera mechanism, and we interviewed her about a year ago. Now, all of the stuff, as I said, is on our website and also our Twitter feeds. The links are all there at Science Weekly. You can also take part in our latest Science Book Club discussion this month. We're dissecting Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, so join in the debate.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Of all the places in the world you can spend time bathing in optimism, the annual TED conferences are probably the daddy. Here, scientists, artists, politicians, and other thinkers present ideas and hopes for a better world. They're usually held in the United States, but once in a while the conferences do come closer to home. Recently, TED Global was held in Oxford, and The Guardian's Kevin Anderson spent a few days musing with some of the intelligent glitterati. In the first of his interviews with some of the speakers for Science Weekly, he spoke to balloonist Bertrand Piccard. Piccard flew around the world in 1999 and was at TED talking about Solar Impulse, a plan to design a single-seat, long-range solar plane.
I believe that we have to show very powerful examples of what can be achieved with renewable energy and energy efficiency. And I believe that the most powerful symbol that we can find is something flying with no fuel, because everybody believes it's impossible. So who can the most, can the least? We try to achieve the most in order to encourage people to do the least. That means use renewables for heating systems, air cons, cars, computers, well, everywhere it's possible. The technology is already here. The problem is the lack of political vision.
So right now, the kind of plane you're looking to build, it's basically, how many people will it carry?
So it carries one pilot only. It needs a wingspan of 64 meters, like an Airbus 340 or a jumbo jet. But it has the weight of a normal car, 1,600 kilos. And it can fly with the energy of a big Christmas tree. So this is what we can achieve now. Of course, we are not yet at the stage where it's possible to fly with 200 passengers with no fuel, but it's not the goal. The goal now is clearly to show that today we can already fly with no fuel and open the door and see who will also explore and find other possibilities in the future.
So right now, are you looking to explore new technologies by developing this plan, or is it more an inspirational effort?
I would say it's both. But we don't have the possibilities to invent new batteries or new solar cells. We have to take what exists. Sometimes it's not yet on the shelf, but it's in the labs and we can use them. We can make them more efficient. We can combine them, which means that all together is revolutionary because it has never been done in that way. But the goal, I would say, is more the symbol. You know, after all, aviation makes 5% maximum of the climate change problem, greenhouse effect problem. So 95% has to change first. And what we want to do is not to revolutionize aviation, but to revolutionize the 95% which can be inspired by it.
Where are you at in the process?
We have now an airplane. It's so nice to be able to say that because, you know, during 6 years, I was saying we will have an airplane. Now we have an airplane. And we have to test it to make the first test flights end of this year and the first high altitude flights next year. And when this works, we can start to make several cycles in the air, day, night, day, and so on.
So is there a way that people can get involved? I mean, is there a participation element with this?
Absolutely. We have a supporters program, which allows, and this has been done because so many people were asking that question, how can we participate? So at one, in the beginning of the program, they can just sign up, it's free, they can get informed what we're doing, get advisors, feed us back with their ideas and so on. And at the other end, people can adopt a solar cell of the plane, they can have their name written on the airplane, they can have VIP visits of the flight test and so on. So it's a nice program and a lot of people are adopting solar cells. It's really nice. They put their name, the sentence, the flag of their country, their picture on the web with the cell they have chosen. So it starts to be nice. We launched that 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago.
So it sounds like you're coming to the point of realizing this dream. You seem like a person who has the next dream in mind. What's the next project?
My next project has a link with this project. The goal is clearly to use this airplane as a promotion for renewable energies, for energy efficiency. Once we've flown around the world with that plane, everybody would like to see it, to touch it, maybe to try it, because maybe we can make by the time a two-seater. And if we can take the president or prime minister of a country, then he will be obliged to commit himself, not only stand on the picture on the solar plane, he has to do something also. So I think it's a powerful vector.
That was The Guardian's Kevin Anderson speaking with balloonist Bertrand Piccard. We'll have more interviews from Ted in the coming weeks, but you can find more of Kevin's write-ups from the conference at guardian.co.uk/science/blog. For more on all the stories you've heard today, you can go to our website, guardian.co.uk/science/environment. And don't forget, there's a competition on the Science blog. This is where you can win 13 episodes of Carl Sagan's Cosmos. Just answer the very simple question. Also, if you head to our podcast page, you can find links to our Twitter feeds, which literally tell you what's happening at our desks minute by minute. You can imagine how interesting that gets. Get onto it at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Thanks to our guest, Adam Rutherford, and also to The Guardian's Ian Sample and Kevin Anderson. Until next week, I'm Alok Jha. The programme is produced by Scott Corley. Thanks for listening.